This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Londonist Out Loud is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. And actually, we decided to put Squarespace through its paces. We're very proud of the London blog we run, but we thought, what the hell, let's try putting another one together in super quick time. So we got on the case using Squarespace. It's very easy indeed. There were some beautiful templates to work with. The customer support was second to none. And within just 1 hour, we'd made a fantastic looking blog all about Peckham. Take a look at our post on the subject. See what you think. Squarespace could not be simpler to use. And because you listen to this show, there's a freebie here for you. You can start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code Londonist to get 10% off your first purchase. You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and listener, I need from you this week some Blitz spirit, if you please. We had this great idea that for a podcast that spends so much of its time looking at London's history, wouldn't it be interesting to actually consider the processes in understanding history themselves? And so, armed with these lofty ideas, we found a location that seemed agreeable. And okay, so Chiswick House and Gardens has an historical flavour to it, but it's not really central to what we were talking about. So given the fact that we could have recorded this almost anywhere, imagine our chagrin as we discovered that we were going to be spending the whole recording fighting with jet aircraft. We did our best. We persevered. I hope you'll persevere with us. If you've ever tried to have a conversation with your hairdresser while they've got the dryers going, you'll have no trouble with today's recording.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Hello, hello from West London, from the foot of the M4. We are surrounded by greenery and rain, and we may have picked the wrong day to visit a gardens, but visiting a gardens is exactly what we're doing. I'm with Matthew Lyons. He's the author of The Favourite, amongst other things. He's an historian, and he is regarding with suspicion the dreadful weather.
Good afternoon, Nick.
Good afternoon. We're up against it here, aren't we? We've not only the incoming flights to Heathrow, which are really making their presence felt. We're about 2 inches from the plane above us. We've also got wildlife all around us.
Well, there appears to be a very large chorus of birds in the tree nearby, which may be the West London parakeets. I'm not much of an ornithologist, but they're certainly shouting away. Perhaps they don't like the rain any more than we do.
It makes you wonder why parakeets would have come to a rainy place like this and set up home and flourished. Why are they only in West London as well, by the way?
I think they escaped from some collection at some point decades past. Certainly in Ealing, which is where I live, they're in the park, the trees are full of them at different times of the year, which is very beautiful and slightly surreal.
We are here to, well, a little bit talk about the place that we're in, but we're also going to talk more widely about history itself.
Yeah, I have a column in History Today, and which I've talked quite frequently about, the idea of public history, which is you might think the fairly obvious idea that, that historians, academic historians, ought to be engaging with the public, in, because history is, you know, core to our civil and political life and our cultural life and sense of identity as a people and as a nation. But it's actually an idea that is, in many respects, sort of anathema to the historical academy, and they often view it with suspicion. And, you know, it, the way historical argument tends to be developed within the academy is within quite some narrow silos of learning, and it tends to be quite exclusive and presented in quite an exclusive language, whereas actually it ought, history perhaps more than any other of the humanities really, it ought to be out in the public marketplace, in the you know, marketplace of ideas and thoughts about who we are and what we are and where we're going in the future. I mean, if you look at debates about whether we ought to be in the EU, they're essentially debates about our historical identity as a nation, or, you know, the debates around Scottish independence at a smaller level, you know, the controversy around the statue of Cecil Rhodes at Oxford, whether that ought to be taken down because of his history as an imperialist. These are all subjects in which history is certainly relevant, but really is at the core of everything. And if academic historians aren't engaging with the public about these subjects, I think that's a huge loss.
It's interesting that all of those items that you enumerated there, they're all about identity. And I guess that makes sense, you know, like Bob Marley said, you need to know who you were so that you can know where you're going. That's starting me down the train of wondering whether that's all history is about identity.
There is the question of what, you know, how we got here, which is always an interesting question. And I think how we perceive the past is a constantly changing thing. Obviously, you know, to take the Victorians, they saw, you know, a grand national narrative which many of them led up towards the empire and a sort of providential sense of English nationhood, very much rooted in an argument about history. And, you know, more contemporary debates about, well, that's been flipped on its head, and arguments about Britain as an imperialist oppressor, as central to the transatlantic slave trade. And, you know, those are all kind of moral arguments, really, about what kind of nation, what kind of people we are, how we deal with things we've done in the past, how we try not to make mistakes in the future, what we learn from political practice, social practice. I mean, you know, what you tend to learn, you know, the more you look at history, obviously, the more complex and less simple it is, and you see, you know, nuances and shades of grey, and even within perceived absolutes, such as, you know, I'm currently working on a book about the dissolution, and we tend to, I think, often still look at that in very kind of grand political terms about Henry, about the break with Rome, and about arguments about political power and the money that Henry got from the monasteries, as well as defeating, if you or destroying, if you like, a potential power base within the country that might oppose his marital plans. But at a much smaller level, it's also about, you know, the monasteries were, it's an anachronism, but the monasteries were the National Health Service. They were provided most of the education throughout the country. So when they were dissolved, a whole level of care of, you know, the elderly, the infirm, the mentally ill, all that disappeared. So you have a grand political statement to dissolution of the monasteries, brilliantly done by Cromwell, but also at a small level you have a dissolution of communities and a social help, social structure, which, you know, you can arguably see echoes of today in debates about the future of the National Health Service, about how we're changing our education, or the government wants to change our education system.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask about that, because the incidents that you give there, it seems retrospectively a very clear-cut moment where Henry wrested power from the church. Do you see that same kind of power struggle in what's going on maybe today? And by today, I mean the last 20 years, perhaps, with unions being turned on their head and there being these challenges to their power from government?
Yeah, well, the debate about where political power resides is an interesting and complex one, and you can see, I mean, you talked about the unions, we can see perhaps in the way that Jeremy Corbyn's idea of the Labour movement is, you know, one of built around grassroots campaigning and that kind of collective action, to some extent supportive of direct action, you know, on the streets and so on. That's a very different idea of democratic engagement to the, I suppose, more administrative political one, which sees power as, in many respects, coming down. There's, you know, elections and so on, but power comes down from Downing Street, from Parliament, through local government, and is, if you like, enacted on the people. And then, you know, that kind of argument, I suppose, which is in some ways about whether power is centralised or whether it's at a local, you know, grassroots level, is one that's gone on certainly since like the Norman Conquest, and you can see certainly the Tudors, Henry VIII, Elizabeth I, were very, very engaged in centralising power, which for them, well, certainly for Elizabeth and later monarchs, it meant diluting the power of, you know, the great families, if not breaking up their fiefdoms, and certainly weakening the structures which enabled them to have that kind of regional power. I mean, Elizabeth had uprising in the Northern Rebellion of 1569, which was essentially in partly about religion, and the old northern families tended to be more Catholic, but it was also about their sense of political power draining away, and the government under Cecil, you know, slowly trying to centralise decision making and, yeah, diluting the power, the regional powers, the regional polities at which, you know, the great families, the Percys and the Nevilles and so on, were at the head.
And they actually had a couple of the Starks executed.
Well, yeah. It's interesting, you know, the Duke of Norfolk, who was executed in 1572, if I remember correctly, used to actually say that when he was in his home, I can't remember which house it was, he was king of his own domain, he was, you know, king of my own country. And that's precisely the sort of attitude that sent shivers down, quite rightly sent shivers down the spine of Elizabeth I and her ministers. I mean, he was ultimately executed for a very foolish plot to marry Queen of Scots and have her put on the throne. But that sense of a huge sense of obviously entitlement was, you know, prevalent amongst the great families, and obviously that lasted, took centuries really to be erased. I mean, arguably it's still there, and you can say in the House of Lords and the kind of ideas and ability and patronage and power.
By the way, actually, before we go a step further, I've realised that we've got a topical link here, because everything you're saying will be jangling in the brain of the Game of Thrones fan who's been enjoying power struggles of exactly that sort. Are you a fan?
I do enjoy it. I've missed out for various reasons on the last couple of series, but I think it's Game of Thrones is brilliant. It's a very clever weaving of, you know, fantasy elements with the kind of political dynastic struggles of, you know, Renaissance Sicily and late medieval, early modern England.
I was going to ask whether somebody with your background and your specialism, whether you would be watching that and spotting plot lines.
No. I mean, I think that way madness lies, doesn't it? You need to try and step back and enjoy what he does really well, I think. As, you know, with, I think, a lot of great television shows like The Wire, you know, there are people who behave immorally and who are evil or whatever, but you also, the shows in some ways don't judge them, and they come full circle, so you become to see how their motivations come out of their own circumstances and issues that they've had, like the Kingslayer, for instance. Obviously he throws Ned Stark's son out the window, and obviously he killed the last king, but the narrative evolves. You begin to see where his...
Just in case somebody hasn't seen the more recent... I don't think what you said early on there was a spoiler, because that happened in episode one. So as far as absolutes go then, do examples come to mind of absolutes getting in the way that are being made more nuanced? An example of something where people have thought of it as being a black and white issue, but now we've got a little bit more colour to it.
I think if, for instance, you know, last year was the anniversary of, you know, the Magna Carta, which on one level is held up as a great, you know, document that enshrines our rights. I mean, the more you look at the history of the Magna Carta, actually that wasn't, you know, a contemporary view. It's a view that emerged really out of the debates and around parliamentary sovereignty and about the divine right of kings that went on in the early 17th century, which ultimately led to the Civil War. It was, if you like, rediscovered as a document. I mean, obviously, it hadn't gone away, but it earned a potency then that it hadn't had for the, you know, previous three or four centuries, which rolled forward into the, you know, American War of Independence and so on, and in there to a Bill of Rights and so on, and that is sort of the legacy of it. But in itself, it's actually a more complex document, more rooted in the politics of 1215 and the power struggle between King John and the barons, which is again another power struggle between, you know, a monarch who obviously wants to assert his absolute authority and less nobility or greater nobility who want to assert their independence and their sort of feudal rights against the overriding, if you like, national right. So it's ongoing. As you know, there's across the arc of history, there are always struggles between, you know, super-regional, super-national powers and more local, you know, regional powers, whether those are about great families or about smaller democratic units. I mean, you could look at the movement for independence in Scotland is about freedom from what they perceive to be domination by England and by Westminster, and wanting to devolve power, because that is power being given. They want to take power back from the UK, to secede from the UK. That's really another version of the same debate, and obviously the same debate is going on with the EU, whether we should step out of the supranational body and be more independent, or whether our future is best served by binding ourselves into a larger polity.
We're going to talk about Chiswick House, because we can't be at Chiswick House without saying something about Chiswick House. But if I don't ask somebody with the sort of long view that you've got with your background, I'd be a fool. So Europe, what should we do there?
I find it hard to be enthusiastic about Europe. However, I do think it best serves our national interests economically and culturally and politically to be in Europe.
And you're basing that on what?
I think that, you know, the trend towards globalisation means smaller polities are going to inevitably have less and less power. And I think having a place in Europe within the EU amplifies our power. And I think without it, our ability to negotiate trade deals and have a voice on the world stage is greatly diminished. I think the argument for leaving is more emotional than economic and intellectual.
People would bang their fist on the table and say, no, it's very much an economic argument.
Yeah, this is just my perception, obviously. I think it comes from a sense of our identity and nation being diluted, and which is obviously in some respects is one of the forces that's driving the move for Scottish independence. And it's a perfectly legitimate view, but I suspect that for most of us life would be exactly the same afterwards, with, you know, maybe more complications when we go to France for holidays or whatever. But I think it's more of a sense of where are the long term, where history is going, whether history is going towards smaller independent nations or cultural units within larger frameworks, or are they entirely independent? I tend to think that the Leave campaign is based in a sense of historical British identity, which looks back to, you know, the days of empire and our colonial power, and when Britain's voice and position on the world stage was much greater, and I think it hankers after that kind of, you know, grand isolation, if you like, holding the balance of power between the US and Europe from the outside as a kind of pivotal place and pivotal market in the world. I tend to think that the world has moved on from there, and that the balance of power is, if anything, swinging east away from America and Europe towards China and India. Therefore, you know, we will become increasingly marginalised if we marginalise ourselves from Europe. There was a very good book out, I think last year, Peter Frankland wrote a really, really good book called Silk Road, which is essentially that the core argument is about how we misunderstand the last two millennia, because we see it from the West point, from the perspective of the West, and it's all about how much originated and how much power actually has resided and still and continues to reside and will reside even more in the East. I'd really recommend that. It's also a really beautiful book.
And that, I don't know if you feel the same way, for me that seems to get to the core of how history evolves, is that it's about changing perspectives, whether that's through time or geographically or by some other means. You know, some of those big demographic things like race or gender, or the way that they evolve, and we see them from a new perspective and we understand. And maybe that's at the core of my distrust of the idea that we go it alone, is that I feel like that view is positioned 50 years ago.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, history is all about where you're standing from when you look at the past. And I tend to think the isolationist view is one that is based in a sentimental, small-c conservative idea of our strength as a nation. I mean, it exists on the left as well as on the right, but I think it's conservative and backward-looking.
Well, collaboration is what it's all about, and you're talking about public history, which sounds, again, as though it's a case of walls being broken down and people working together a little bit more. Yeah. Can we say some more about drawing the public into history?
I think there's a discomfort with many academic historians about, engaging with the public. I think there's a kind of distrust of the idea of engagement and of standing in the public square within the academy that comes from, partly I think it comes from, inevitably a lot of academic work is looking in quite a lot of detail at quite small areas within history or within culture, within art and so on, and those are often difficult ideas and narratives to place before the public without a great deal of explanation. I mean, what's great about Peter's book is it has this vast canvas. It's hugely detailed, but it also has this vast canvas and a really strong, big argument. Whereas I think with a lot of academic writing across the humanities, they're quite small, detailed arguments, and they tend to get wrapped up in a lot of jargon, for want of a better word, which is quite exclusive.
And you've got to be into that area of history in the first place.
An academic, English academic called Andy Kesson, who's at Roehampton, is working on a project with Lucy Munro at King's College about the London playhouses of the early modern period. And he wrote a really great blog last week, I think.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Where we're talking in the context of Shakespeare, and I suppose to some extent Shakespeare 400, saying the trend in academic studies is towards very micro study, where there's gravitational force of Shakespeare, but within Shakespeare it tends towards very micro study of his work and so on. And actually no one has really stepped back and looked at the playhouses as the cultural infrastructure that enabled Shakespeare and his contemporaries to happen. And so he and Lucy have a project, I think it's called Before Shakespeare, but essentially it's a big academic 3 or 4 year project looking at all the playhouses, which hasn't really been done before, which is it's almost like the elephant in the room thing. Everyone's looking at the elephant's tusks or whatever, but actually how did we get to a place where there were this thriving dramatic culture?
Yeah, suddenly this incredible culture. Proliferation all at once.
Yeah, so it kind of explodes in the 1570s or whatever, but no one's really looked at. I mean, obviously there were the playhouses, later the Globe, the Curtain, the Theatre, the Rose, and so on. But also there were all plays being performed in lots of inns around London. I mean, we think about the players going on tour outside of London, when the playhouses were shut or whatever. But actually, they could in practice tour in London as well. The Cross Keys in Gracechurch Street, and so on,
and others.
yeah.
We should talk about the setting that we have got around us here, Chiswick House. What do we know about Chiswick House?
Well, I mean, Chiswick House is built, as I understand, it's built on the current Chiswick House, which is sort of near Palladian, built and I think designed by Lord Burlington in the early 18th century. Stand to be corrected on that if I'm wrong. And it's built on the site of a Jacobean house. I mean, one of the things when we're talking about Shakespeare, one of the things that's interesting about this, the great collector and sort of establisher of the idea of Palladian architecture in England or in Britain was Inigo Jones. And I think some of the designs for this house were based on designs that he had collected from Palladio in Italy. And there's a statue to Inigo Jones. I mean, going back to Shakespeare and Shakespeare 400 and, again, questions of identity, Inigo Jones worked with Ben Jonson, as well as being the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. It's also the 400th anniversary of Johnson's first folio, which actually was the first time anyone had created that kind of work and set out to establish that kind of to assert the cultural importance of English drama. As you know, before that, plays were published in quite an ad hoc way in quartos and so on. So Johnson made a concerted effort to assert the value of his work and to and the value of drama and English drama as worthy of keeping and sort of study, which I mean, you can certainly argue in terms of Shakespeare, without Johnson's folio, there would be no Shakespeare folio. And there is an argument that Johnson was heavily involved in collating and editing Shakespeare's work. That's kind of unproven.
Shakespeare does talk about the immortality he'll gain through his words, but it sounds, from what you're saying, is that perhaps he wasn't necessarily up the sharp end of making himself immortal, of securing the existence of his texts.
Well, typically for the Elizabethan and Jacobean dramatists, you know, publication wasn't really how they made their money. They made their money through from them being produced on stage. Obviously, Shakespeare, as a shareholder, then had another stream of revenue aside from that. But publication was, it's not a perfect analogy, but 20th century pop culture is quite disposable, and it's only, you know, in recent decades that it's been perceived as, you know, collectible and valuable in its own right. So if you look back, or 20th century film, you look back at the first 20 years of cinema, there's huge numbers of lost films because people didn't think they were going to be worth preserving. Same with Elizabethan drama. It was, you know, off the moment. They performed, you know, three or four nights maybe, and then the troops were on to the next play. So it's quite disposable kind of culture, and it's only in retrospect, I think, that we look back and think of them as, thanks to Johnson in part, as worthy of collection and reverence.
That reminds me very much of the, we talked about the 20th century pop culture, so I was thinking of zines and some of the material that would accompany bands that didn't necessarily make it big, but it was very much the grassroots of the music scene in perhaps the 80s, and indeed blog culture now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you can see the patterns repeating and repeating. I mean, I guess, you know, in 50 years' time, people will be searching for the video games of the 80s and the 90s and the e-zines and the comics. And, well, people are, you know, comics now from the 40s and 50s are, you know, collector's items and increasingly seen as culturally important in a way that they certainly weren't when they first appeared.
Was Inigo Jones, because I'd love to focus on that him for a moment. He pops up in various different places. It seems as though he worked in, am I right in saying he worked in different fields, quite literally?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was primarily an architect, but, you know, in a very kind of Renaissance way, he was something of a, you know, polymath. My knowledge of him is mostly based around his work on masks with Johnson, when they had quite a difficult relationship. And essentially, I mean, for those who don't know, masks were quite short plays that were put on once at court. I mean, it's primarily a feature of the Jacobean and Caroline court. Huge spectaculars, cost a lot of money. Johnson and other writers would write the words, and someone, Inigo Jones or other people, would create these lavish, you know, possibly Berkeley style extravaganza.
So this was the musical of its era, wasn't it?
I guess they weren't necessarily song. They had songs, dance. I mean, sometimes members of the court would perform in them themselves, often quite, for the time, spectacular mechanical effects, huge amounts of money. I mean, they're quite curious artistic things, masks, because they were obviously a celebration of court power and wealth and extravagance. But Johnson certainly regarded himself as something moralist, and if they weren't, you know, we talk now about speaking truth to power. I don't think that's masked with that, but I think for Johnson they were kind of speaking art and morality to power. There's often messages, for want of a better word, or ideas about political power that are encoded in them. And I mean, Johnson and Jones, there's a statue to Inigo Jones here around the court from where we're sitting, which I imagine Johnson would have been infuriated by, because they had a terrible working relationship. Because obviously he was paid a relatively small amount of money to the amount of money that got spent on spectacle, and I think often when they were acted at court, a lot of the attention went to the visual element, as we do now. You know, the visual element of films is what we take away often, and Johnson, being the kind of person that he was, resented that greatly. He tended to resent a lot of things, but he certainly resented the attention and money lavished on Jones.
Was he a seething man?
He was a man with a very keen sense of his own importance. Quite I would imagine. Well, I'm fairly sure, pretty short-tempered. And also one of those sort of professional troublemakers. He's an odd man because, you know, he sought court patronage and power, but he couldn't resist biting the hand that fed him either. And was constantly in trouble with different political or court authorities about his plays. I mean, he spent some time in prison over one of them. Called before the Privy Council for, you know, sedition. Actually, he was in prison for two plays, I think. You go through his life, there's always falling out with people and offending people about, well, almost anything, really. You know, even though he sought patronage from the court of James I and, I suppose, political influence and money from the court, he was in prison in 1605 for a satire full of abuse about Scots in London. He couldn't resist it, I don't think. And in a way, he's quite an attractive figure. I think his work is hugely undervalued, and I think I would like to see this year a lot more focus being spent on Johnson and his influence, because Shakespeare gets plenty of that.
We could do well with pulling the camera back a bit and seeing all the other playwrights of excellent calibre, and poets as well. They get very little look in until you get to maybe John Donne or someone like that, but there are a lot of fantastic poets around at that time.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I wouldn't deny Shakespeare's genius, but his centrality to a certain kind of view of English culture really serves to demean a lot of other great work and important and hugely relevant work that happened at the same time. It's almost like a marketing phenomenon these days in Shakespeare. So, you know, the culture sector will talk about how much he's worth to Britain's cultural export and so on. And it's, you know, like the monarchy, it's like a sort of heritage attraction. And I don't think it does Shakespeare any good, actually. You know, it's a very kind of, again, top-down, middle-class sense of who Shakespeare is.
Oh, and what's interesting as well is, just as we were talking earlier on about the evolution of ideas in history, Shakespeare 150 years ago was not a big deal. He wasn't regarded as being such an important figure as he is today.
Yeah, it's certainly like for the first sort of 100 years, I mean, Johnson was considered the more important figure. Through to the Restoration, Johnson had a much larger sort of cultural imprint, and the deification of Shakespeare sort of begins, a couple of hundred years later, really. I suppose it ties in to some extent with the Romantic movement and ideas about, I suppose, emotional identity, and there's a particular kind of humanism and individualism in Shakespeare which, you know, has resonated with us for the last couple of hundred years. But it's quite... Sorry, I'm just pausing to look at some ducks who have come to join.
We're being assaulted by wildfowl.
I've forgotten what I was saying. What was I saying?
Deification, several hundred years. Yeah. I was distracted by the ducks as well. Listen, Chiswick House needs to earn its keep. You mentioned the Neo-Palladian style. We've mentioned the Jacobean origins. What else do we know about Chiswick House?
This is a good question.
I always think when somebody tells me of it, it's a good question. I always think that's code for something.
That's code for give me a minute to think.
So not a good question necessarily, actually. Quite the reverse.
I can't quite remember. Hang on a second. this was essentially the country retreat of Lord Burlington, of Burlington Arcade fame.
That's him.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know Burlington Arcade, it's just off Regent Street, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's, land that he used to own, and I don't think he had any particular connection to the shops that are there now. It's a very high-end little arcade of tailors and such, I think.
Yeah, but I was going to ask what it was when he owned it. No idea.
No,
I'll have to find out.
I think it's built on land owned by his family. I think possibly. I have an idea. I could Google it, actually. I have an idea that the Royal Academy used to be his house. Hang on a second.
Do you know, we get into such trouble. I should say there are one or two people who, when they hear an historian or an enthusiast of any sort, need to look something up or not know absolutely exhaustively everything about the subject. We get emails that, he doesn't know anything about anything, call himself an historian and all that. And I think that's a little unfair, really. I don't think knowing absolutely everything in the world comes with the job title.
Well, yeah, no, and I will give you the classic historian of defence of it's not my period.
Is that why people are so specialist then, so that everything's not their period?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's not my field of study. All-purpose defence, really. the Royal Academy's Burlington House, isn't it? And I assume that was the family house. well, obviously the London residents, this in Chiswick, then would have been way out in the burbs.
Yeah, we'd have been very much in the countryside. Mm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is looking at the housing stock around here, I'd say it was late 19th century. It became part of London, I would guess.
Can we talk more generally about what West London has to offer? The other possible venues that we could have met at would have been where?
Well, I mean, there's a whole slew of houses that I guess would, like this one, have been country residences over in Ely. You've got Pitsanger Manor, which was John Soane's house, which I think is currently undergoing renovation, going to be reopened, I think, next year, which is good, actually. For quite a number of years, it suffered neglect is probably an overstatement, but it's been in need of some TLC, and it's getting that now, and that's great. And they've redesigned Walpole Park, which used to be the gardens, but is now a lovely public park, and they've redesigned that along the lines of the original design, with additional cafe and other facilities for children. There's Ham House over in Ham.
Sion Park, am I in the right?
Sion Park, Duke of Northumberland's place, a huge mansion over by Kew. Still owned by the Duke of Northumberland, actually. I mean, going back to what we were saying earlier, I mean, that's the Percy family, back through English history. We're talking about how wealth and power and privilege cascades or streams down generations. The Sion House is a huge house, and recently built a hotel in the grounds. I think it's a Hilton, a huge hotel. There used to be a butterfly sanctuary there, which was lovely, and they pulled that down to build a hotel.
I'm devastated. That was a wonderful butterfly sanctuary.
Yeah, it was gorgeous and strange, actually. I mean, I'm not aware of any other. I'm sure there are such places, but it was kind of a novelty. But yeah, no money talks. I mean, the site, as I said a little bit earlier, I'm working on the work about the distribution of the monasteries, and Sion House was built on Benedictine nunnery, which was dissolved in 1538-1539, and the current house is Adam House from the early 18th century. I mean, it's interesting, looking at the distribution of the monasteries and the monastic imprint on London life. It's very interesting, actually, looking back at early modern sources, and people like Stowe talking about, you get a very strong sense of even, 60, 70 years later, of a London still, as it was, after the Blitz or in the latter half of the 20th century, London with monastic ruins around, with monastic buildings that have been repurposed into domestic houses, primarily for the wealthy. I mean, some of the Blackfriars was converted into essentially high-end apartments for people like the Earl of Oxford and so on, and also tying back in with Shakespeare, there was a theatre there, as you know, later on in the early 17th century. You just have to look at a map of London and look at Blackfriars, Greyfriars, Whitefriars, Covent Garden, the imprint of monastic London, of the monasteries and the architectural and, if you like, cultural imprint is still there. And I think one of the interesting things is looking at architecturally what happened to the monasteries. Obviously some were completely demolished, Lewes Priory being a classic example, which Cromwell took for himself, essentially hired an Italian engineer to demolish, and there's, I don't know, one or two courses of brickwork now. There's literally nothing there. Two, great houses. Obviously, many parishes retained priory churches or conventual churches as their parish church, and the remainder buildings were demolished. Some of the cathedrals were former religious, the churches of religious houses. Some were repurposed for, domestic houses for the wealthy. So the uses to which the physical property was put, a little history of England and their own. The sense of wealth passing from, obviously, the monasteries are curious, and I think it's quite hard for us to appreciate now exactly how central they were to cultural and economic life. Obviously, they were quite substantial employers, landowners and so on. And, although they were in many ways reserved from the public, they also were very integrated into local public and rural and city life. So key parts of the local economy, leaving aside education and healthcare, as I mentioned earlier. So when they went, there was essentially a huge privatisation of a kind of national wealth. And I think when you see it in that kind of frame, you see it's quite interesting kind of contemporary resonances in terms of you know, ongoing arguments. You talked earlier about the breaking of union power, and that obviously went along with politically privatisation of nationalised industries and nationalised services, and debates, you know, now about to what extent the national health service should use private companies to deliver various services, you know, whether within hospitals or in terms of community support. I mean, these are all questions of who owns wealth and who benefits from how wealth sort of resides in the community. These are all ongoing conversations.
Hmm. Unlike ours, which unfortunately must be no more. We've come to the end of our time here at Chiswick House. If people want to rush out and secure a copy of a volume of your work, by what name does it go?
Well, my latest book is The Favourite, a book about Elizabeth I and Walter Raleigh and their relationship.
As in, it's called The Favourite.
It is indeed called The Favourite. And yes, available from all good booksellers online and in the real world.
Matthew Lyons, thanks very much.
Many thanks.
My heart aches for some far off place, no one could have left you.
And that is all for this week. My thanks for this week to Matthew Lyons. Thanks to Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm Anne Quentin Wolfe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.